that this may not sound like as confusing of a thing to you as it is in reality, the church is universal and it's one, then if the priest goes and gets stationed on a mission over in some other country of the world, like Austria, New Zealand, Germany, the Holy Land, South America, who knows, then don't you see what a big contradiction it is? Or even here in the United States, if they had these missions and some priest started staying down in San Diego or Los Angeles, Phoenix, Colorado Springs, they wouldn't have access to these ordos until they were passed due. Like some of the ordos we did receive, we didn't receive until about 2 days left in the month. Many of them when the month was about half over. So the first half of the month still didn't help us out any because we didn't have the order to go by. But in other words, if the missionary priests are going to pray the office and offer Holy Mass, it's not going to be the same according to the universal calendar of the Latin Rite. Like I said, it's not even the same among the few oblate priests that were in the community when I left. The year I left, I prayed the office of Mary Mediatrix of All Graces 3 times. Bishop Francis Conrad Mayer has his Angel Day birthday on July 10th. Well, Pope Pius XII suppressed the Feast of Mary Mediatrix of All Graces used to be on May 31st when he instituted the Feast of Mary Immaculate Queen. Bishop Francis Conrad Maria reinstated that feast that Pius XII suppressed, but he had the feast celebrated on his birthday, July 10th, so that be more of a justified reason to celebrate it. Like brothers, always when there's summer missions, we were gone during that time, or I should have said summer vacations, whatever they called it. We usually were in Seattle and celebrated the bishop's birthday, and the people, of course, don't celebrate their birthdays in community much, but that's a secondary point. If you recall that last year, 1983, I think it was, Bishop Francis Conrad Murray happened to be in the community. And so that year, he was very sick, and we didn't celebrate his birthday then. It was later on at the, they had the school program for the summer, that general time, but not that specific day, I don't think it was. Maybe I forgot the exact day of the program, but anyway, that day we, at least I remember praying or beginning the office for Mary Mediatrix of All Graces because we've been doing it for all these years. And then later in the day, in the afternoon or whenever, we're told, no, there's a different feast that has been transferred. Just transferred to a couple days or a week or so later, if I recall, when there was another ferial day, because it wasn't going to work out to celebrate Bishop's feast day, so we prayed a different office even. And so when this new day that was transferred to came along, I prayed the office again for Mary Mediatrix of All Graces, or at least started and prayed most of it. Then I'm told again, no, it's transferred. And then Divine Providence had us sent on down to Phoenix to minister the sacraments to that lady who was dying. And we ended up staying down there for a couple of weeks. And then I was told that this is when the feast is going to be. They called us over the phone. And I went ahead and prayed it again, third time now, for a feast that Pius XII had suppressed. But we finally offered the Mass and prayed the office for Mary Mediatrix of All Graces. And here it is, the last part of July. And they're finally celebrating the Feast of Corpus Christi up in the community. And that actually didn't take place until the Sunday we got back up there. It was a total confusing thing. But I'm saying the Feast of Corpus Christi, a very definite first-class feast in the Universal Church, was postponed and postponed. Finally got started on a Friday night, I think it was, late Thursday night and early Friday morning, And they actually, when I got back to the community on Sunday night, they were then going to start the ceremony that particular Sunday. It wasn't even a mass offered at Mount St. Michael's, although there was one scheduled, because the bishop was going to offer these ceremonies for Corpus Christi or First Communion. Kind of forgotten the details now, but there's no mass. The Sunday mass was offered about 2 to 3 o'clock on Monday morning. There was all the religious brothers, most of the sisters, all the lay people. Didn't even get to receive communion that time. You know how they used to give communion out during this daylight savings time after midnight, but before 1 o'clock or maybe 10 after 1, like it happened at least once. A few minutes after 1 was close enough to count as communion the past day. I didn't even have the mass. Total confusing thing. How can this be the church that shows goodness, truth, and beauty, the attributes of God? How can it be one? How can it be universal? You see what this means? And like the Feast of Epiphany, no ceremonies if sexuality can't be there offered them. Let's take like what is really happening then if you carry it on through. It means that in one parish, if these missions would ever be organized, then the priest would offer the mass at the time when it should have been offered according to the rubrics of Pius XII. Another priest may be somewhat sick or ill, so he offers and has everything a couple days later or a couple weeks later. Then the bishop was even more sick than that priest was. He offers it a couple months later, maybe. Like, I guess, you see, they still haven't blessed the candles for the purification. Probably haven't blessed the things for Epiphany yet. Easter doesn't happen until 2 weeks late on Good Shepherd Sunday. Christmas Mass is offered in the middle of Lent. See what this is happening? Pretty soon you'll have Christmas Day on Good Friday, Easter Day on All Souls. Who knows what's going to happen? See, it's not gone that far, but certainly has gone too far to be the one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, isn't it?
Well, that's all I'm going to play of that tape for now, because we're still on the subject of canon law. But I played this rather long section from this tape I'd made on June 1st, 1984, to try and make it more evident that if we follow the opinion that was, so to speak, taught by Bishop Shuckard and what Father Dennis Philemon Ray speaks of here in writing a reply to Father Alphonsus Barnes. Father, we both know that in these times canon law is not strictly applicable, but is rather a norm for our guidance. If that is what we follow, then indeed we are in trouble, because we see that that is what Bishop Shuckard followed. And if he had only followed the canon law promulgated by Pope Benedict XV, then none of those things would have ever taken place that we just made comment upon, which ended up in people not even belonging to the one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church, because it was not one in its liturgy, as we have explained on another tape. If you simply follow what Pope Pius XII wrote in Media Luce Dei and put that together with the Catechism of the Council of Trent, when it explains the mark of the Church, one Holy Catholic and Apostolic. But now recall to mind the many changes that Bishop Shuckard brought about in the order, as we've only explained a small part of them in this tape we've just listened to. As I read a short paragraph from a book titled Ready Answers in Canon Law, a practical summary of the code for the parish clergy, Reverend P.J. Leiden, D.D., and it's published by Benzinger Brothers Incorporated, 1948. It has an imprimatur by Johannes J. Mitty, Archbishop of San Francisco, February 10th, 1948, in Nickel Upstate by B.M. Blank, O.P. Reading on page 445 under the main heading Ordo. The properly approved calendar or Ordo is to be followed even though it is probable that its directions are wrong. When it is certain that the Ordo contains an error at variance with the rubrics of the missal or breviary, it is not to be followed. And in parentheses it says SRC number 2748. So we obviously should see that since the first Ordo was put out under the direction of Bishop Shuckard, not one Ordo in all those years that he did function after 1976 could have been followed if only we would have simply known our religion and lived this which we just read about. But again, I repeat, all of these drastic changes came about simply because they did not follow canon law. And yet we hear them say that canon law does not strictly apply today. It is only a norm for our guidance. But let us then seriously now think about the true teachings of the Catholic Church. We know from what we've already heard here that Pope Benedict XV promulgated the Code of Canon Law, and he said it would become effective on Pentecost 1918, giving thereby everyone 1 year's time to study it, to know it, to be able to be ready to put it into practice. And now I'm going to ask some questions. It was promulgated effective Pentecost 1918. There is a validly ordained priest, or even a validly consecrated bishop, and he then certainly has the power of orders. But we must remember that in this code of canon law that Pope Benedict XV promulgated in Pentecost 1918, it says under Canon 872 that in addition to the power of orders for the valid absolution of sins, there is required in the minister the power of jurisdiction, whether ordinary or delegated over the penitent. Therefore, this priest, although validly ordained, does not have jurisdiction. Either he has lost his office, or he's never received jurisdiction, never has had it from any Catholic authority, although he is validly ordained. Let us then assume that he's in a situation where he can not invoke Canon 209 or any other canon or a combination of all the canons in the code in order to obtain jurisdiction. And he certainly cannot ever invoke Epikaia, for Epikaia cannot be invoked to obtain jurisdiction, as we hope to be able to explain better later in these tapes. And therefore, there is no way that this priest or bishop has the necessary jurisdiction. The simple question then is, a penitent comes to him and on the penitent's part makes a good confession fulfilling his requirements as far as he knew. This priest or bishop has the proper form of the sacrament, and according to the general rubrics, he does everything correctly. The penitent, of course, applying the matter. And he has the intention even to absolve that penitent. Is that confession valid? The answer is no, because he does not have the necessary jurisdiction. From the information I have, Bishop Arnold Harris Matthews, whom Bishop Shuckart traces back through, died in December of 1919. Therefore, he would have been living at this time. And everyone says, not everyone, but a good number of people strongly insist that he was validly ordained. I'm asking then, if he heard someone's confession fulfilling all these requirements, but still not able to invoke Epikaia, of course, nor any canons to obtain jurisdiction, are his confessions that he hears valid? Obviously, no. Let us then move on to maybe 20 years after the code is promulgated by Benedict XV, in about 1938, October. If the same conditions are fulfilled in another priest, under the same conditions, here's a confession, without having any jurisdiction and not able to invoke it in any way through canon law, and of course, I repeat once more, can never obtain it through Epikaya, are the confessions he hears valid? No. If then someone, a few days before the death of Pope Pius XII in October of 1958, was under the same conditions, and he heard those confessions, or a confession, would that be valid? The answer is still no. If after the death of Pope Pius XII, is there any way that priest could have heard a valid confession under the same conditions of not having any jurisdiction? The answer again is no. So we see here the importance of canon law. And we also see why Bishop Shuckard and so many others today say that canon law does not strictly apply. It's only a norm for our guidance. Because today they are saying, in effect, that Bishop Daniel Q. Brown some way obtained jurisdiction, although he did not receive it from the Catholic Church, which is an impossibility. Or they some way assume that Bishop Shuckard had jurisdiction. And obviously, if Bishop Shuckard was guilty of those many sins of immorality that Father Dennis Filomree accused him of and has all this proof for, being excommunicated every time he absolved an accomplice in sin, those who lived in the community are aware that from the time he was consecrated in 1971 until Father Clement Kubich came to the community, the bishop heard a good number of confessions, you might say, about anyone who went to confession. And even after that, he heard a good number of confessions. But remember what we told you from the teachings of St. Thomas Aquinas and others, that the excommunicated, as well as those in heresy and schism, do not have any jurisdiction in the church. Therefore, the same principles certainly do apply, and none of those confessions were valid. A very shocking thing, maybe the first time some people are going to hear this, but how could it be otherwise if you simply follow the teachings of the true church? No wonder they say they do not apply. And if Bishop Francis Shuckard himself never had any jurisdiction in the true church, he certainly never gave any jurisdiction to any of the priests he ordained, nor to Father Clement Kubich, or to any other priest. Therefore, the obvious conclusion must follow that none of them had Catholic jurisdiction, and there's no way they could have invoked Canon 209 that I know of, or any other canon or combinations of them. And I repeat once more, they cannot invoke Epikaya for the sacraments and other reasons that we hope to explain shortly. The obvious conclusion follows then that if they follow the teaching of the true church, everyone knows then that those confessions were not valid. No wonder they say that canon law does not strictly apply, because for the only logical explanation is that all of those acts that were illicit and even invalid before the death of Pope Pius XII, because then Catholics lived according to canon law, promulgated in a solemn way by Benedict XV, and maybe changed or whatever by other popes following him, but nevertheless only changed by a true pope, so that whatever the canon law read the day that Pope Pius XII died was to be lived and followed by all the Catholic world. And what I again say, those in the community of Mary Immaculate Queen, and as well as many others, are trying to tell us today, is that the code simply changes to fit their own needs, whereas Pope Benedict XV himself, in promulgating the Code of Canon Law, tells us under Canon 436 that nothing is to be changed during the vacancy of a see. And so when the see was vacant at the death of Pope Pius XII, the canon laws were fixed and they will remain that way. But for those who follow the heretical beliefs that canon law is not strictly to be applied and that it's only a norm of guidance and that it does change by anyone, and I guess everyone who wants it to change for their own personal or whatever type needs, I want to then try and pin them down. Did it change the day after Pope Pius XII died? The week after he died? The month after he died? The first year? At the death of John the 23rd? The death of Paul the 6th? The death of JP I? Or is it still going on? What date did it change? And who has the authority to change it? And what changes are made? The Catholic Church has always been very clear in her teachings on such important matters. Such, again, we return to the tape that Bishop George Musey, might say, made in giving his talk to the communion April 22nd, 1985. If you recall, he made a type of parable how the popes in the past have already given us the directions of how to guide the ship into the safe harbor by following Mary, the star of the sea. But the whole crux of his parable was that we must follow the guidance of the true popes who lived in the past, meaning, of course, from Pope Pius XII back through to St. Peter. And obviously, then, what he said was very true. But when we deviate and do not follow these teachings, then we're not going to arrive at the harbor of eternal life with God. And those who say they're following Mary, the star of the sea, and do not follow that guidance, obviously the conclusion follows, and you know what it is. So as a final summary to the subject of canon law for now, I would just remind everyone that this assertion that canon law no longer binds, or does not strictly bind, is a very blatant heresy. Jesus Christ, our Lord himself, granted to the church the power of making laws to govern, and this is what the ruling power of the church is all about. This is how the church rules us. It has those three duties, and this is how the duty of ruling the church, I repeat, comes about, by our laws. And these laws are a divine institution. For one example, Jesus told us, he who hears you, hears me. And these laws of the church, then, have always remained in force unless repealed by a valid pope. Never has it ever been even suggested during these previous 260 times that popes have died in the past, when there was that period of interregnum. Indeed, never was it even suggested by anyone who was a true Catholic that any of the laws of the church no longer were to be followed strictly and absolutely. And let us then simply reflect that Jesus Christ, the eternal truth, who can in no way deceive us or be deceived, has made it very plain in more than one place in the scriptures that it's the keeping of his commandments that is so important. If you love me, keep my commandments. If thou wilt enter into eternal life, keep my commandments. Keep the laws, the commandments I have laid down for you if you wish to save your soul. It's not by breaking them, and that's what is done when you freely interpret them or say they do not apply. And if we are going to follow Mary, the star of the sea, then let us think of the fourth joyful mystery of the presentation and the purification of Mary, where we see this immaculate, pure Mother of God obedient to the law even when it was not necessary. Let us have this attitude, to be obedient in every way to the most minute detail, as Jesus Christ was, obedient unto death. It is consummated. What my Father has given to me, I have accomplished. How can Jesus Christ, after telling us so plainly what he has told us, ever condemn us, or ever truly even punish us in the least way by following his laws and the laws of his church in every minute detail. Never can it be done, because he is truth and he has himself approved these laws. Let us then realize that Jesus Christ, our judge, nor his mother Mary, in any way will ever inflict punishment on those who do follow their commandments, the laws of their church. However, whether people believe it or not, if they break the laws still bind. Just whether people believe in hell or not, hell is still there. And if they don't believe in it, they're going to be there forever.
And with that being said, maybe this is a point that we should move into the discussion of epikeia, or equity. And I have tried to do a good amount of research on this subject, as well as others, looking in the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas, various moral theology books, and so on, in order to get a complete understanding of this subject as possible, and also to have the opinion of many, get the other side, as Father Dennis Willimini pointed out, as we quoted on the first part of this tape. And then I came across a reference book entitled The History, Nature, and Use of Epikeia in Moral Theology by the Reverend Lawrence Joseph Riley, A.B., S.T.L., put out by the Catholic University of America Studies in Sacred Theology, second series, number 17. It has the imprimatur of Richard Jacob Cushing, D.D., Archbishop of Boston, and Nikhil Upstate of Francis J. Connell, C.S.S.R., S.T.D. It has a copyright 1948 by the Catholic University of America Press, Incorporated. And I was able to obtain this book by going downtown here to the local library, which is not really a very large library, but they have what they call their microfiche system. And one of the ladies who kind of runs the library, if you give her the name and author and title of a book, she looks up in this microfiche and then, in our case, sends a report up to Phoenix, and they research it, who has it in their library someplace in the United States, and they send it there, and then they send it here, and you can check it out for 2 weeks, in our case. And this particular book came from Chicago originally, but I mention this because this book, as I said, gives the history, nature, and use of epikeia in moral theology. It contains 495 pages, and the bibliography used gives 24 sources altogether, plus about 600 other reference works. And this author then, in reading him, very well indicates that he has a very thorough knowledge, but and giving forth this information in the book, he states the definition of all the different theologians or whoever spoke on the subject, whether it be St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Alphonsus Maria Liguori, Suarez, Vermage, Plumer. In other words, he just gives everyone's idea, basically speaking, and then you can form your idea, and he tells you then the teachings of the church on the matter. And from this book, then, I will be making a number of references in this subject that we are going to now discuss. And on page 130 and 131, it reads, many modern moralists adhere to the teaching that epikeia, strictly so called, is concerned exclusively with cases in regard to which the legislator has power to bind his subject, but is believed not to be willing to do so. And then he gives the names of 12 theologians who support that definition. And on page 137, it reads, for the definition of epikeia, despite the broad development that has been made in regard to the concept of epikeia since Aristotle discussed it, any clear notion of it must be based essentially upon his explanation Keeping that explanation in mind, we may define epikaya as a correction or emendation of a law which in its expression is deficient by reason of its universality. A correction made by a subject who deviates from the clear words of the law, basing his action upon the presumption, at least probable, that the legislator intended not to include in his law the case at hand. And then on page 189, he lists some practical points as a summary of the things that have been discussed previous to this page. Before any endeavor is made to illustrate the foregoing principles, this observation should be made. Practically all authors who treat of epikaya insist that it may be used only with the greatest discretion and prudence. Arbitrarily resort to it would be dangerous and would open the door to all manner of abuses. Davis, for example, warns that, quote, its use should be prudent and reasonable, since self-interest is apt to mislead us, unquote. Similar words of caution are uttered by authorities on civil law. Speaking of Aristotelian epikaya, Allen says, quote, we are on slippery ground when we speak of doing that for the law, which the law has not done for itself, unquote. Clark states, attention must be called here, however, to the common weakness of individuals to consider their own case exceptional. It is sometimes true that exceptions ought to be made, that needless hardships would result if the rule were applied to his case. But the index to the exception is the needlessness of the hardship, not in the hardship alone. Inconvenience and even suffering are sometimes solitary and involve no injustice. If hardship were a justification for exception to the rule, we should have to permit exceptions even to intrinsically good rules. End of Clark's statement. Another point to which attention must be paid is that an individual who would seem to be justified in using epikaya may often be prevented from doing so by reason of the fact that deviation from the words of the law would give rise to scandal. Because the supreme law of charity often obliges one to undergo serious inconveniences in order to avoid giving such scandal. One author declares that, quote, it is only in occult cases that the liberty of epikaya is complete, unquote. It is one thing for a priest to admit the recitation of the breviary by using epikaya. It is quite another to deviate from the law of abstinence in public by resorting to epikaya. What is per se sufficient reason for deviating from the words of the law may per accidents become entirely insufficient. One may observe in passing that occasions for the licit use of epikaya surely will not be so frequent as to cause an individual to form any habit. And on page 191, Dens points out that for the lawful use of epikaya, there is required at least as grave a reason as is necessary for obtaining a dispensation. Stape asserts that a much more serious reason is demanded than suffices for the granting of a dispensation. Without entering into a consideration of this question, we may consider some of the following cases mentioned by theologians. On the day of his first public mass, a newly ordained priest inadvertently breaks his fast. May he apply epikaya to the ecclesiastical precept which forbids the celebration of Mass when one's fast has been broken after midnight. When one considers the circumstances which usually surround such an occasion, it may reasonably be presumed that the Church does not wish to include such a case in her law. In other words, epikaya may not be invoked for that situation. Goes on a few pages later, more examples. A priest who has been assigned to offer two masses on a Sunday or holy day of obligation inadvertently takes the absolution at the end of his first mass. May he use epikaya and celebrate the second mass if no other priest is available to substitute for him. It is generally agreed that the mere fact that the faithful could not otherwise hear Mass is not sufficient reason to allow a priest who is not fasting to celebrate Mass. This is clear from a decision of the Holy Office given on December 2nd, 1874, and there's a footnote. The decision also indicates that fear of scandal or wonder by the faithful is likewise insufficient reason. It seems likely, however, that the term scandal, as here used, refers to admiratio populi. Continuing now with the text of Father Riley. Now, it may be true that since dispensations from fasting are today granted somewhat more liberally than in the past, the law of fasting is probably not so strictly to be interpreted as previously. However, there seems to be no sound reason to suppose that anything less than the danger of real scandal or of serious infamy will render permissible deviation from the words of the law here under consideration. That is to say, the priest in the case in question may offer Mass only if he prudently judges that the ecclesiastical precept is in conflict with the natural law. And in such a case, epikaia, strictly so called, is not invoked. This, in substance, seems to be the view of many modern theologians, namely, that Mass may be offered by a priest who is not fasting only when to omit it would result in the danger of grave scandal or infamy. It would seem to be a prudent judgment that such might usually ensue when the Mass is to be a public parish Mass, and so the Holy Sacrifice might be celebrated under these circumstances. And there's another footnote given here. It is the belief of Anglin that, quote, a changed viewpoint concerning the question of fact has emerged since 1874, and the opinion of the majority of present-day theologians and canonists, the danger of scandal is nearly always present in such a case. Hence, they would follow a priest to say second Mass. Hence, they would allow a priest to say a second Mass in these circumstances. There would be a lurking suspicion in the minds of at least some people as to why the priest was not able to celebrate the Holy Sacrifice, unless the priest is so very well known to his people that he enjoys a reputation among them that is beyond all danger of reproach and suspicion. In practice, it pertains to the individual priest to judge, according to the accepted principles, whether or not he would feel justified in saying a second Mass after having inadvertently broken his fast. And back to the text again. But the fact remains that it is not in virtue of the use of epikaia, strictly understood, that such will be permissible. And so this then gives us some of the general ideas of how grave the necessity must be before epikaia can be invoked, and how it can only be invoked for certain circumstances. And before going into a deep, detailed explanation of what circumstances it can and cannot be invoked for, let us read the conclusions given at the end of this book by Father Riley on pages 459 and 460. Number one, epikaia is a lawful institute of moral theology based ultimately on the intention of the legislator to exclude from his law a particular case, and hence the presumed intention of the legislator is in the highest import in regard to epikaia. For epikaia, properly so called, is concerned not with the lack of power in the legislature to include a particular case in his law, but rather with his will not to do so. Number two, epikaia may be defined as follows: a correction or emendation of a law which in its expression is deficient by reason of its universality. A correction made by a subject who deviates from the clear words of the law, basing his action upon the presumption, at least probable, that the legislature intended not to include in his law the case at hand. Three, the intention of the legislature not to include a particular case in his law is not a merely interpretive intention, but exists in the mind of the legislature, at least virtually, though perhaps only implicitly. For epikeia may be used only with the greatest discretion. In the internal form, it may be applied to affirmative precepts and to negative precepts, ecclesiastical and civil, but very infrequently with regard to the affirmative precepts, because the latter binding semper, but not pro semper, are more susceptible of interpretation than of epikeia. 5. Epikeia may be used not only when advantage would occur to the community, but likewise in cases where the good of an individual only is concerned. Moreover, the good may have reference to the avoidance of a damnum or to the gaining of a lucrum. 6. In an instance in which the legislature's intention not to include the case in his law is known with certainty, recourse to a superior is not necessary. In a case where the evidence regarding this presumed intention of the legislature is so unsubstantial that the subject cannot even hesitatingly assent that he is free, epikeia may not be used. If the subject can make a soundly probable judgment that the circumstances of the particular case at hand are such that the legislature will not include it in his law, he may deviate from the words of the law on the strength of that presumed intention of the legislature, but only when recourse to a superior is impossible, and when there cannot be a delay until such a time as recourse becomes possible. 7. Epikeia is related to prudence, in that it is directed by the virtue of gome, a potential part of prudence. It is probable that epikeia is a subjective part of the virtue of equitas, which is a potential part of the virtue of justice. 8. Epikeia, properly so called, has no standing in civil law insofar as the external forum is concerned. 9. Epikeia is not to be identified with interpretation, dispensation, presumed permission, excusing cause, or popular acceptance of human law. 10. Epikeia may not be applied to precepts of the natural law, nor to precepts of the divine positive law of the New Testament. 11. It seems probable that the use of epikeia was not permissible in reference to precepts of the divine positive law of the Old Testament. 12. Human invalidating laws sometimes cease to bind, but epikeia may not be applied to human invalidating laws. And of these 12 conclusions, for our purposes now, I think that number 10 and 12 are very important. Let me reread them to express it more strongly. Epikeia may not be applied to precepts of the natural law, nor to precepts of the divine positive law of the New Testament. And 12. Human invalidating laws sometimes cease to bind, but epikeia may not be applied to human invalidating laws.